overview today. And with this, I know is Barry Cass, and I see Mr. Naughton is here with him. Just a couple of housekeeping items that for individuals who are in the audience, if you have a cell phone on you, please make certain that you have turned it off so that it does not interrupt the proceedings. And also for those of you who is the first time that you have attended these hearings, we have a Rosie, and Rosie has a friend, and Rosie is our bank, our piggy bank, that on the one hand encourages you to use acronyms, because when you use acronyms, you're going to contribute to Rosie, so that Rosie, at the end of session, the funds that have been collected will go to Oregon Food Bank to feed the needy and those who are hungry. So what was it last week, I think, we were very pleased that Dr. Stan Mazerhart was here, because he made outstanding contributions last week. He just could not avoid all those acronyms. With that, we will open, and Barry, you may proceed and go ahead, unless we have from our...
Nothing?
Okay, let's go.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Barry Cast. I'm the Assistant Director for Health Services from the Department of Human Services. And for the next 2 days, we're going to be talking about the offices in our public health section of health services. And I'll walk you through this afternoon as a form of introduction, and then each of those office administrators will be here to talk in detail about what they do. As a way of introduction, let me say first that I don't think there's anybody who doesn't worry about his health, her health, or the health of a loved one. And whether it's worrying about getting ill with some chronic disease like cancer or diabetes, or something very much more sudden and acute and scary like meningococcal disease or this thing that's happening in Asia, everybody has that anxiety. Public health, in contrast to a good deal of what happens in the Department of Human Services, is really unique. Although we do have some programs that are focused on individual clients, people who come in for service, we're more concerned about the state as a whole and the whole population and its health and quality of life. In other words, the essence of public health is prevention, keeping things from happening that are of concern to all of us. And as I mentioned in my introduction last week, a good deal of the enhanced quality that we enjoy in our society and the extension of life that has been going on for more than a couple of centuries is due really to public health kinds of interventions rather than healthcare services. For example, assuring that we have clean water so that we don't drink contaminated water, become ill, and die. And it's really rare these days to see the kinds of gross epidemics that were commonplace a little more than 100 years ago. So as we move through this, we're going to be talking about functions that we perform that keep people from getting sick. And so the ways in which we measure what we do is considerably different than the other kinds of service areas that we have been talking about, including last week's discussion of mental health services. Public health is organized around three core functions. The first is assessment. And in order to make good assessments of what's happening in the health of the public, we need abundant amounts of data. And one of the foundations of public health are the data systems that give us the information we need on a daily basis to know, for example, if there's an emerging illness that we need to deal with, where it's happening, what patterns we can use to understand its dynamics and to bring about a plan that will control it. That second phase, the planning and policy development, is another component, a core component of public health. Our job really is to understand and to develop strategies. Most of our field, the people who actually do the work in public systems and with individuals who have become ill, is done by local health departments. We don't have our own field. We rely on counties and other contractors to get the work done. But we do have some assurances that we make to the public. And through the communication of those expectations, those requirements, those targets and plans, which are implemented locally, we can rapidly understand a disease and bring it under control, or develop a plan for making corrective actions in a water system. I want to emphasize that what we do as a state agency is really work with local partners, and that is a critical component. So you have at least two major foundational things to consider here. One is the extensive use of data, and the other is our reliance on a field that is based locally in each of Oregon's communities. Oregon law really identifies in statute five fundamental functions of public health: communicable disease, maternal and child health, environmental health, vital statistics and records, and health information and referral. And to this I would add the statutory role of the state public health officer. Grant Higginson, our public health officer, will be here in a few minutes to talk about what his functions are and how his office operates. To have an effective prevention strategy, we need a lot of data, as I mentioned. We need trained analysts, people who are experts in their field, who understand specific illnesses, specific agents, microbiologists, toxicologists, people who are really very focused on the kind of specific categories of things that we do. And a third element is preparedness. That is, most of what we do is to prevent things from happening, and we want to be prepared to respond when something unpredictable arises. So capacity is the key. Capacity is the key, not just service provision. In 1988, the Institute of Medicine took a look at public health systems in this country and found them lacking, seriously lacking, and there have been a number of efforts since then. One of the more recent was shortly before the September 11th attacks. There was a report published at the federal level which identified public health systems as public safety systems and cautioned the country about the need for greater preparedness. And, of course, we know since 9/11 and the anthrax episodes and other threats that are being considered now, that has become something of a national emergency, and you'll hear in a few minutes about what we're doing to respond to that. But, in fact, Oregon has been engaged for more than a decade on public health improvement. We had an extended grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which I believe actually expires today. We have produced, I think, a model for how we might improve our public health systems. And we have a bill in front of this session, a substantive bill, that would provide an interim mechanism for looking at those strategies for improvement and bringing them forward to the next legislative assembly. If you look, and now we're in the section of the book, and I don't know how yours are organized, but mine says under the public health tab, which is red, page 2-4, identifies for you the key goals in strengthening public health in Oregon. And I'm not going to recite them for you, but I wanted to draw your attention to them because they do put a frame around what we're trying to accomplish in these offices. If you turn to the very beginning of the section, you should see an organizational table looks something like this. Mine's right at the beginning before the table of contents, before 2-1.
Right behind the red tab.
And what I'd like to do is just say a few things about each of these offices so that you know how we're organized and how we're staffed. And you may... we've shaded the offices that are related specifically to public health functions so that you get a picture of the distribution of these services throughout health services in the department. First, we have an office of the state public health officer. If you go through the governor's balanced budget, you may find this office referred to by another name, which is the Office of Health Planning and Community Liaison. For example, the federal investment in preparedness increase, I found that we needed to have those services, those efforts, organized under a program director and preferably one with statutory authority. So we put those functions in Grant Higginson's office and renamed it and reorganized it, and we're making some modifications which we can describe for you in more detail.
very questioning your organization, affecting your number of positions. And I'm looking at the health services page, not just the public health. In each one of those, is that the current number of positions, and are there any vacancies within each one of those categories?
Madam Chair, those are the currently authorized positions.
And do you have any vacant positions?
Yes, we do.
Can you give me the vacant positions and where they are within the cluster?
Madam Chair, we can. Actually, the department has been, as you know, we have, under the governor's direction, have frozen vacancies. We have an exception process. Some positions remain vacant, and the department is producing a complete list of where those vacancies are. And actually, in preparing for the governor's revised, we are looking at every position to see whether it is essential and what its future will be.
So, Mr. Naughton, will we get all of the vacancy positions when we get the governor's new budget?
Madam Chair, the process that we're working through with their legislative fiscal office is that we are, in essence, refreezing all the PICS-driven positions, and we will then come forward with you and say, here's what was in the budget. Here are all the positions that are vacant as of a certain point when we refreeze all of those, and that will be part of the work session that your legislative fiscal office works through with you.
Just didn't want to miss them.
You can have it, Madam Chair.
If you add up, Madam Chair, the positions in public health, they amount to 581 positions and 566 FTE. Mm-hmm. And I want to repeat that there are other people in community settings that are funded with state and federal revenues that are, in effect, our field, that aren't accounted for in this description. Dr. Higginson's office includes the linkages with our county partners, reviewing certain health-related plans to assure that they meet standards and will protect public health. We have some special projects like the administration of the medical marijuana program, which he will describe for you, and other forms of health planning. And the overwhelming task now is in working with the governor's security council in bringing forward plans for public health preparedness in the event of bioterrorism or other attack. Dr. Cohn also has a number of statutory responsibilities that are, a long list of those, but his office includes those specific functions that are listed there. The Office of Disease Prevention and Epidemiology is the branch that is really concerned about acute and chronic disease and the environmental effects on health of certain toxic substances as well as occupational injuries. And you can see there the sections in Dr. Cohn's office, and I anticipate that he will have his presentation before you and complete it today as well. That office works very closely with the Centers for Disease Control, which is the primary source of financing for these kinds of functions. And there are a large number of separate grants which propel those services or those sections forward and keep them moving toward improved data, improved assessment, and strategies to preserve the health of our population. Donalda Dodson is the administrator of our Office of Family Health. This is the office where you will find the WIC program, Women, Infants, and Children. And I will prepay my benefit here. The Women, Infants, and Children program is a nutritional program, but it's really linked to gaining access to pregnant women and women with very young children to assure that they're not only getting the nutritional supplements they need, but also the health care that they need. We also have an extensive program in child health, including pre- and perinatal health, immunization. We have a program on a section on women's and reproductive health, and a new grant regarding oral health services. And I was surprised to learn myself that oral diseases are the most prevalent diseases in childhood. I was surprised to hear that.
I think if you had talked to our dental community, they would readily agree.
They would, Madam Chair, and we did worked very closely not only with the dental community but also with the Office of Medical Assistance Program in securing this grant. And, of course, the provision of dental services in the future is one of the decisions that the legislature will need to make as it allocates resources. Gail Shibley is the administrator of our Office of Public Health Systems. You can think of the Office of Public Health Systems as, in effect, the regulatory branch of this enterprise. There you'll find the drinking water program, a licensing of hospitals and other healthcare settings, emergency medical services, trauma services, radiation protection, a very interesting section. And environmental services and consultation includes the food service program. Food service program is kind of the backbone of environmental health. It's a core function at the local level. And there are about 10,000 food service establishments in Oregon, and each of them has to be inspected and licensed. And as you know, Madam Chair, there's a good deal of controversy about food service, and I hope that we can bring you some good news about our work with the Oregon Restaurant Association and the Conference of Local Health Officials. Mike Skeels, that you some of you may know from his previous work.
Just for the panel, the members, part of the discussion is talking about consistency across the state. The Oregon Restaurant Association, which I am a member, have long sought that what happens in Yamhill County should also be the same as what happens in Marion County, or whether you're talking about in Burns and Deschutes. So there's been some discussion with the agency of how do we get consistency across the state, not only from the standpoint of inspection, but the same applies when you're looking at the fee structure and what have you. So I know that they have been working with the administrator, Grant Higginson, and they've had some very positive discussions in trying to solve this particular problem of inconsistency.
Madam Chair, thank you. I do want to take a moment just to thank Dr. Higginson for taking not only his regular responsibilities, but also leading this office for the past 6 months as we had a change in executive service. And Gail Shibley, who's joined us within the past 4 or 5 weeks, I think has the kind of experience as a former legislator and a former public administrator to lead that office, and I think we're very pleased that she's joined the staff. Mike Skeels is a microbiologist and past administrator of the Oregon Health Division about 8 or 10 years ago. He runs the Office of the State Public Health Laboratories. It's plural because of the number of various things we do in our laboratory, including a program which expanded dramatically after last session with the expansion of our newborn screening program. The laboratory is also a critical element in preparedness in the event of bioterrorism or some other threat. And they also do some measure of licensing with other labs around the state. And finally, but certainly not least, Vicky Nakashima heads the Office of Multicultural Health, which was established following an executive order of the governor in 1999. This is an office which has an overarching concern not only about public health, but all of health services, and looks at racial and ethnic disparities, the importance of culturally competent service delivery that reflects the needs of various racial and ethnic subgroups, and is working hard to expand opportunities for people from minorities to participate in health professions, which is one way you can achieve a greater diversity of workforce can produce more relevant and culturally competent services.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordon.
I just want to, if I may, correct something I think I heard. Governor Kitzhaber, by executive order in 1999, did establish a racial and ethnic health task force, the governor's racial and ethnic health task force, but the Office of Multicultural Health predated that executive order.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, you are quite correct. It's my error. The reason that I bring that confusion to the table is that I see the Office of Multicultural Health as providing staffing and taking direction from the task force, which has been, at least for me, in the 20 months that I've been doing this, an education about the health status of Oregonians and some of the inequities that we deal with. So it I put the two of them together in my mind, but Senator Gordley's quite correct that the executive order did not establish this office. And I think an important question will be the adequacy of this office to provide the support that the task force has been accustomed to in the future. It's very important that we continue to track these trends. The task force report illuminates several areas that are of critical importance to us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would say that the issue is the adequacy of support for the office of multicultural health. That would be legislative support. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I was thinking of fiscal, financial support to be able to continue.
Thank you.
As I pointed out, if you turn to page 2-17, as I pointed out last Monday, this is an area, a part of the department, which is uses only 1% of health services general fund. Public health services are largely dependent, first, on federal fund support. There are a variety of grants from the Centers for Disease Control, the Health Resources Services Administration, the Environmental Protection Agency, and so on. And a second major source of support are fees that are linked to the services provided. So, for example, the newborn screening program is supported by fees for each newborn whose blood is being tested. Our drinking water program is supported by fees. Our radiation program is supported by fees. General fund is really only 7% of this public health budget. I think you can see the distribution here. The Women, Infants, and Children program is 30% of the total, and these are non-limited federal funds. So they're, it's in a sense, you should sort of take that piece of the pie and set it aside in examining the budget of this program. Total funds are $370 million. An important trend in public health has been the reduced fraction of our resources that actually come from state general funds as our budget's been under pressure, and as the federal government has increased its support for certain targeted public health services. I mentioned earlier that prevention is keeps us from getting sick. It is a huge cost avoidance strategy. And if you look to page 227, you will see a listing of some of the ways we save money by providing a public health program. So, for example, and these aren't my numbers, this is from the research and so forth, that each dollar spent in vaccinating children and the public at large saves $16 in treatment. A dollar in the Women, Infants, and Children program saves $3 in Medicaid costs. A dollar in the HIV prevention program would save $20 in treatment costs. So I think I said last week that as I've been looking at the whole spectrum of health services from very expensive health care to public health services, this is one of the best investments that the state of Oregon can make.
Barry, question. Because I know you have a dollar, tobacco prevention saves $30 in treatment. With the number one, as I understand it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, medical cost driver now, and it's our overabundance of food intake, obesity. Is there anything that the agency is planning to or thinking about in that particular realm? Because that is a major. Has become a major cost item in our society.
Madam Chair, yes, indeed. And Dr. Cohn will have more specific detail about that, but I will say that we do have a letter requesting permission to apply for a Centers for Disease Control grant for both genetics and I think what's called physical activity and nutrition, basically is a response to the epidemic of obesity which we're seeing in our not only here in Oregon, but across the country. I wanted to point out that the costs that are avoided are not just costs in terms of state-borne costs. It's also the costs in human suffering, in social effects, and the economic effects of disease and disability.
Madam Chair?
Representative Wesley.
Two questions, if I may. Barry, what is
on 227, what is DTP?
Diphtheria, pertussis.
Three of them.
Diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis, Madam Chair, Representative Westland.
Okay, and then secondly, Madam Chair, is Mr. Cass responsible for the acronyms in this publication? I believe.
I think he probably is, since he's the the head. But he said he was going to pay in advance.
Madam Chair, I've got to point out that the position that I occupy is not a statutory one, and I'll have to talk to Gene Thorne about the acronyms in published materials from the department. What does MMR stand for?
Measles, mumps,
and rubella.
Rubella.
Right. HIV, everyone.
You can cost ship that money to Barry. I mean.
Or maybe we could cost ship it to the who prepared the document.
We will hunt them down and make sure they make a contribution. We had, Madam Chair, to continue, we had two budget notes in the public health area from the last session. One calls for a report on the relocation of the public health programs, then referred to as the Oregon Health Division, to Salem. And I will transmit that report in the next day or so in its full text. We've had assistance from DAS and the Department of Administrative Services in the preparation of that. A second report, which was actually provided to the Emergency Board in January of 2002, identified the gaps in our communicable disease preparedness and service delivery, and also addressed the importance of state and local partnership in planning for the allocation of resources and in bringing a budget forward that you could evaluate. That report, I have copies of it, and Mr. Britton will make them available to the committee just in the event that you don't have them from the emergency board. We've talked about the permission to apply for the federal grant. I wanted to also note that an error I made in the first day is that I was under the impression that the Secretary of State's audit of our drinking water programs occurred in this interim. Actually, that report was made in January of 2001. But we have spent a good deal of the last 2 years thinking about how we can address the deficiencies that were identified there. And when Gail Shibley is here, she will walk through the drinking water program with you and talk about what needs to be done in response to that audit. We've identified the benchmarks that are related to this program and our performance indicators. They're listed on pages 2-9 through 2-19. I think I have that right. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? Okay. And rather than recite them, I think we'll be talking about those indicators for you as we present each office. But you'll note one of the things that is striking about public health is that it sort of reaches into every corner of the lives of Oregonians. We're talking about healthy babies, decreasing disability, death, and death, access to health care, which certainly relates to mental health and to the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, reducing teen pregnancy, suicide prevention. It's a very diverse program area, and if you think about our lives, almost everything we do has some aspect of risk where our own behaviors can make a difference in the outcome. And so we're involved across the board in the department's benchmarks and performance measures. Let me just identify a half a dozen key issues, and then we'll get Dr. Higginson here to start talking specifically about his office and the sections there. I've already mentioned that there is a declining availability of general fund for support for public health services. That is falling heavily on local health departments who rely on those dollars to provide communicable disease preparedness, to respond to HIV, tuberculosis, sexually transmitted diseases. I think it's important, and we talked about this with respect to mental health, that we constantly keep in mind the viability and the health of our local partners, because without them, state policy cannot be implemented. A second area is the public's growing concern about communicable disease. And I can't tell you from my own personal experience what the trend has been here, but I do know that almost every day we're becoming acutely aware of new problems with communicable disease, whether it's antibiotic-resistant diseases or this respiratory thing that's going on in Asia. And what comes along with that concern is a sense on the public's part, an expectation that if something happens, we will respond. And I think you'll hear from Dr. Cohn, I hope we have a chance to talk about this at some length, that the West Nile virus, which is approaching our state, I mean, the maps, you can say it's in Spokane, but it's not yet in Olympia and so forth, we're likely to see West Nile virus in the state soon. And there's a limited repertoire of responses to that. And so we are using what we know about preparedness to get ready for that, the public's concern about West Nile virus. And the public expects us to act. They don't expect us to be passive or to say, in effect, we don't have the resources to fix that problem. The public wants to be protected. One area of importance to us now is the tobacco prevention and education program. Now, this program has been suspended for several months, pending the adoption of the next budget. This is one of our most successful prevention programs. We've reduced the use of tobacco products by 30% among adults. We've reduced the rate of smoking by teenagers. It's a very successful program, and it's a complicated one, and we will bring you some additional information about that. You will have an important decision to make about that program. Our state public health laboratory is currently resides in a converted parking garage at Portland State University. It's an acceptable facility, but it has outgrown its footprint. And we have been spending the last couple of years working on how we can solve that problem. And it's amplified by the fact that Portland State would like us to move since they need the space, since they're growing as well. And we will have a report for you about the public health lab and what our options are, as well as what the Department of Administrative Services is doing to help us solve this problem. A fifth issue concerns our regulatory functions. As I mentioned, expectations are increasing, and there are increasing public demands to be protected from everything from mold to radon, lead in drinking water, and so forth. But as expectations are increasing, the public is concerned about assuring that there's some constraint on fees, and yet all of these functions are supported by fees. So we have a dilemma, because what we can do depends on what we can afford. I mentioned that we think we have some progress to report to you in the food service, food protection area. We also have some concerns about improving our drinking water program. And finally, and not least, the concern that we have about health disparities persists, and we need to do more than we have done. I think I mentioned with mental health that we have increased the access to services by African Americans, Hispanics, Native Americans. But we still, when we look at the data, we see a very disparate prevalence of certain diseases, certain behaviors in different populations. And we need to target our efforts to address that. And we've been receiving a lot of help on that from the task force in giving us some direction. But we need a strategy, we need a plan, and it's going to take time to implement. We want you to have some information about that. So in a few minutes, Vicki Nakashima will be here to talk about that.
And Barry, before we go into a work session, your agency will provide us the priority listing so that we can talk about what
my
is...
My last point, Madam Chair, and I've
did
given
I,
Mr.
Did
Britton...
I jump gun?
Pardon?
Go ahead.
We have a listing of in what we think is priority order of 97 discrete programs in public health. And because of the diverse array of programs and the difficulty of prioritizing asthma and drinking water or licensing a radiation equipment versus tuberculosis, I've taken the liberty of breaking out by office these priorities and displayed them according to the public health overall ranking and the internal ranking within that office. And the two are lined up. It's just to give you a more intimate sense in each office of how they view their own activities. And each office administrator is prepared to discuss those priorities with you. as they come forward. And unless there are some specific questions, I'll
Senator Gordon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Cass, the chair, in her wisdom and also drawing on her great experience, has said to our committee that in looking at the principles by which we will look at funding choices, that one of those principles will be services for children. And so I was listening for two things. I was listening for the issue of health disparities, which is on the list, but I didn't hear anything that specifically relates to a concern about the health care and access to health care for children. And when I think, for example, about the missed opportunities to increase the enrollment of numbers of children in the Children's Health Insurance Program, also known as CHIP, it just leads me to ask, where does that issue fall in your list of priorities and concerns? I know that increasing the enrollment of children in that particular program also is listed as one of the performance measures or benchmarks for public health services under the overall goal of people are healthy. So again, if you could just respond to me and to us with your views of how you are looking at the overall issue of access to health care for children, it would be helpful to me.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, the governor has said children will come first in his budget, and we are looking in our work with the legislature around the governor's balanced budget and what other changes we may need to make about how we will fund as you referred to it, the CHIP program, the Children's Health Insurance Program. And it's vital that we do that because there are among the uninsured are large numbers of children in our state who don't have access to health care. But as a public health program, children are here in a variety of ways. And let me say a few things about that. Part of the work of Dr. Higginson's office is looking at issues of primary care access and rural health care and the whole question of the safety net, which we talked about, because there are a large number of people, and many of them children, who don't have any coverage. And so there's planning that's happening there. The Office of Family Health has programs that are specifically targeted toward increasing access for children and assuring the health of Oregon's children. Sadly, some of the things that they've been doing have eroded during this recession because of the reductions in general fund. The most important of those in that office is the school-based health centers, which have produced dramatic results and which are actually will be able to continue at some level in many locations without state general funds. But those general funds supported things like teen pregnancy and primary care access for children who had no place else to go. That office also has worked closely with the Commission on Children and Families as part of the children's program for the state. And, of course, a lot of the effort there has been postponed or reduced because of budget pressures. So we're concerned about the health of Oregon's children, and we need to, I think, talk specifically about each of those initiatives and how we're going to sustain them or sustain our capacity to rebuild them when times improve. Children are involved in our Office of Public Health Systems as well. In recent months, in two or three different school districts, there's been an identification of lead in drinking water, and we've been working with local school districts to get strategies in place to reduce children's exposure. So children are everywhere, and in a sense, public health in its broader population-based view never leaves children out. I mean, it's a part of everything that we do. And we have some things on the table for you to look at with respect to our immunization program and continuing our work with local providers in documenting and tracking immunization data, things like that. If I hope that's helpful. I know it's not an essay on children, and I can certainly come back with a more comprehensive view.
The response is helpful somewhat, but again, looking at the list that you've given us, which is the rank in, is that priority order, 1 through 97? The question that comes to my mind is, as you were ranking the priorities, were you also saying children first? And so what we're looking at is a reflection of the governor's principles, which say children first. And so that's what you've also come out with in your rankings. Should we look at it that way, or...
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, children are a critical priority for the governor and for us. But maybe I could share with you the principles that we used in setting priorities that may help explain the sequence here. And would that be helpful?
That would be very helpful. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And although the word children does not appear here, I think I can say that there categories here that where certainly children are at the front of the line, and these are not in order. This is a list. The first principle is to preserve infrastructure, that is to preserve the capacity to continue to provide service and to provide analysis and surveillance and so forth. Second, protect those most vulnerable, and that certainly would include a great number of Oregon's children who are at risk and who rely on us to provide them with protection. To promote equity among populations of interest, and that includes racial and ethnic populations, the disabled, and children. Emphasize access to care. Manage the greatest risks. Avoid high future costs. I'll make a copy of this so that the committee can have. Avoid high future costs. So if we can make a decision today that will prevent us from having to confront that problem later in more expensive form, that's what that means. Leverage funds. There are parts of this budget which leverage extraordinary amounts of federal funds on a matching rates that are one state dollar for 9 federal dollars. And a final priority, that there was no alternative provider available. If we can find somebody else to do this work in the private sector or not-for-profit, we would prefer to do it that way. And I'll make copies of these principles for you. This is a very good question about the priority of children, and we have tried in viewing this not just from public health but across health services. It is a critical factor in our thinking about how to get this budget constructed, particularly in medical assistance programs.
Just to piggyback on Senator Gordley's comments, and I do believe that Mr. Britton sent the guiding principles for this subcommittee to all of the agencies so that when you do rank your priorities that you rank them giving the principles in mind. And I know that the governor and I share the governor's principles of children, and so we had adopted children and seniors, the most vulnerable in our society. So I think that's why Senator Gordley was raising that issue, because we understand that in this budget climate we are going to have to make some tough choices, and those choices are going to come down to not only talk about the structure, what it is, but what can we serve inside of that structure. So we would appreciate your guiding principle list.
Great. Thank you. I'll have that for you tomorrow morning or tomorrow afternoon.
And Ms. Notton, while we're on the subject, do you have any idea of when we can expect the new budget?
Madam Chair, what we've been looking at from the department is to get something by the end of this week as far as their rebalance and their reshoot for the next biennium. So I'll be working with Teresa McHugh to figure out and the governor as to when we actually transmit that along.
Madam Chair, I would like to introduce Grant Higginson. Everyone, I think, here has met Grant. Who heads up the Office of the State Public Health Officer, and will walk us through that set of sections and services.
Welcome, Grant, and as you go through, if you would refer the panel to whatever page you're on so that they don't get lost and have to flip through.
Great. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the State Public Health Officer with Health Services Department of Human Services. And for some of you, my role may be a little confusing, particularly for those people who sat on this committee last session, where I presented the entire health division, the public health agency's budget. As you know, the department was reorganized in August of 2001, and at that time I basically became a special assistant acting as the State Public Health Officer to Barry Cast, the Assistant Director for Health Services. Health Services now includes all of the public health services that we used to have in the Health Division, but no longer a public health agency. About a year into that role, as Barry mentioned just a few minutes ago, with the change of administration in the Office of Public Health Systems, our Environmental Health Unit, I became the acting administrator of that unit for about 5 months. And then with the recent mini reorganization within Health Services, Barry created the Office of the State Public Health Officer. So since January, that has been my role, in addition to the general role of State Public Health Officer and providing Barry support, and also in providing some statutorily required services as well. And the Office of the State Public Health Officer does help the Assistant Director Barry Cast with the overall policy development and planning for health services. But when we were deciding which functional units would make sense to be in the Office of the Public Health Officer, we felt that we should have those ones that cut across a number of different offices within the cluster, or that those programs that cut across a number of departments or divisions as well. Consequently, what we do in the Office of Public Health Services, of the State Public Health Officer, is to provide overall support in things like providing staff for the Conference of Local Health Officials meeting, for the Public Health Advisory Board, and then, as I mentioned, providing those services that are cost-cutting or special projects. So within my office, and you might want to look now at page 4-1, there are four sections. One is public health preparedness, which deals with bioterrorism response and other issues of public health emergencies. The second section is health systems planning. The third is medical marijuana and other special projects. And then the fourth is community liaison, which is our relationship with local health departments, which, as Barry mentioned, is a critical part of the public health system here in Oregon. I've noted at the bottom of the page that as you're trying to compare this document and other documents with your budget documents, there may be some confusion, because now we're the Office of the State Public Health Officer, was previously comprised of programs that were previously in the Office of Health Planning and Community Relations. And so some of the things that we're talking about is actually going to be under that office in your budget documents rather than what is currently the Office of the State Public Health Officer. And so I apologize up front for any confusion there. And also, because of this change, there's also been at least one correction in the document that I will make as we're going along. the first section that I wanted to talk about is public health preparedness. And first to say that this is an issue that we've been dealing with long before September 11th, 2001. That about 5 years ago we started working with the Office of Emergency Management and with law enforcement to look at what we need to be doing in Oregon around weapons of mass destruction and how we were going to manage a grant that we were getting from the federal government through Department of Justice for equipment and other issues for first responders. We also had a bioterrorism grant from the Centers for Disease Control that was funded also prior to 2001, September 11th. So we have been working on these issues for a number of years now. However, with September 11th, 2001, so the world really did change for public health, and it actually wasn't so much 9/11, but the anthrax attacks that followed in October of that year. And what people clearly began to realize is that public health is a critical public safety organization as well as one that's generally promoting the health of the citizens of Oregon and the people of this nation. And consequently, there were pretty rapidly some, for us, large amounts of new federal dollars that came into the state of Oregon. In the period June 2002 through the period August 2003, we were receiving about $14.2 million from the federal government. The bulk of that is coming from the Centers for Disease Control in dealing with public health preparedness and bioterrorism response issues specifically. And then there's also $1.6 million out of that total $14.2 that's coming from the Health Resources and Services Administration, and that's specifically for dealing with hospital biopreparedness, hospital bioterrorism preparedness issues. If you look at public health preparedness and bioterrorism response, there's really three big chunks the way that I see this, and we're responsible for one of them. The piece that we're responsible for is the overall preparedness piece, and so that includes a lot around planning, coordination, education, and training. It also has the components dealing with getting communications technology out into the field. It also deals with having the right kind of risk communications and public information available as well. So my piece is really that overall coordination and preparedness chunk of bioterrorism response and public health preparedness. The second piece is, and you should hear from Mel Cohn about this piece in a little while, is the bioterrorism response piece. The focus of most of these dollars really has been on bioterrorism response as opposed to a broader look at chemical, radiological, conventional issues, conventional weapons as well. And so Mel Cohn shop in the department, the Office of Disease Prevention and Epidemiology is responsible for that bioterrorism response piece. And then the third big chunk is the public health laboratory piece that you'll hear more about from Mike
Grant,
Fields.
Who's responsible for the first line response? And I'm not talking about bioterrorism, but let's say you had an attack similar to 9/11. Which office is responsible for that coordination? And the second part to my question, because I think it was learned in the 9/11 experience in New York and in D.C., is that they did not have the mental health communities and some of the other communities on board. So who's responsible for that range and comprehensive coordination should an event occur?
Right. Madam Chair, there's a framework that we've been using, as I said, really since we started doing this as state level about 5 years ago, and that national framework looks at three legs to a stool: threat, response capacity, and health and medical. The threat piece is figuring out who the bad guys are, what they're capable of doing, what they're thinking about doing, and then stopping them from doing that. And the responsibility there lies with law enforcement agencies here in the state, primarily with state police working with local law enforcement agencies. The second piece, and it's really getting at your question, is that it's the emergency management office, the Office of Emergency Management, that's responsible for the overall coordination of any disaster, regardless of what it is, whether it's natural like a hurricane or a flood or a tsunami, or whether it is human-made, be it biochemical, be it radiological, be it conventional weapons. So they really are the glue that holds everything together. And then, again, regardless of whether it's a human-made or a natural disaster, there are always going to be some health and medical consequences, and it's the public health agency here in Oregon, Health Services, that is responsible for coordinating that. And then in regards to bioterrorism, there are some very specific responsibilities that we have that I'm sure that Dr. Cohn will get into in the future.
You serve on the governor's emergency preparedness group.
Madam Chair, yes, I do. I serve on the Governor's Security Council. Shortly after September 11, 2001, the governor created this Security Council that included his chief of staff and a number of other people from the governor's office, Department of Justice, Department of Environmental Quality, Office of Emergency Management, State Police, National Guard, and State Public Health. And I have been the representative for public health on the Governor's Security Council since this onset.
Just so members don't think that everything in, that we're asleep in Oregon, Senator Gordley, myself, the governor's office, Barry, and others went back to New York and visited 9/11 and was a part of a group to actually talk about planning and the making sure that we had a comprehensive system in place. And Oregon was the only state that included their legislators as policymakers. I just had to put that on record because the other states that were there did not include their legislative branch. And it gave us the opportunity to sit down as a group to really, to work on some of the policy issues and the administrative issues. And I just had that.
Yeah.
Felt very good about Oregon.
Sure.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I wanted to interject. You had also asked about mental health, and one of the things that came out of that group that went to the to visit New York City after 9/11 was the whole idea of the critical need of having mental health services available in the time of disasters. And consequently, when we put in our grant applications to CDC and HRSA, we were told that we were the we were, and
I'll make sure he takes care of his responsibilities.
We were told that we were the only state that had included a position specifically for dealing with mental health issues. That position actually is to focus on mental health tribes and other special populations, and those other special populations include minority groups, the elderly, pregnant women, and children. And Barry had something he wanted to mention.
Madam Chair, if you will, that was really a remarkable opportunity, the New York meeting, partly because New York was in such a state of grief and disruption, but also I think we learned something important about emergencies, and that is that after the attacks, the hospitals were prepared, and there were no patients. But what they weren't prepared for was the psychological and social effects, which massively disrupted that community and particularly affected children in those areas. And we've learned a lot about that, and that's why I think Dr. Richard Templeton has been designated to do that work. And so we have a mental health component there. And it's really not just about treatment. It's really about how communities think about what people need in the wake of a disaster. So I'm glad we had a chance to do that together.
And I will add the other piece, because we actually had the faith-based community with us as well on that trip. Oregon tried to approach it in a very comprehensive way, recognizing that when things like this occur, that it isn't one entity that has to respond to a catastrophe, and I think New York is really in talking to them, learned that even today, that part of the component that they weren't prepared for was the mental health issue.
Madam Chair,
Senator Gordon,
thank you. I really appreciate you reflecting on the experience that we had in New York. And one of the learnings that stays with me, because it underscores the importance of having a very, very strong link to faith communities, one of the learnings involved what happened in the aftermath of the anthrax situation in D.C. and at one of the post offices. As you may recall, Madam Chair, members of the D.C. Faith Community literally rushed to the post office to counsel and be with the employees who were affected and who were many of whom were fearful, but their entry was blocked by the Red Cross, who said, you know, according to our protocols, you can't come in. And so that was one of the learnings from the D.C. experience in that community, was in recognizing that in developing future protocols, they needed to be inclusive of the faith community right up front, so that that role could be played out. So again, that's something that has stayed with me from that experience. Just thought I'd share it now.
And just to go through some of the accomplishments of our Public Health Preparedness Office, if you start on 4.3, and I won't go through all of these, but we have done a lot in the way of planning, so that now the state has revised our health medical plan as part of the state's overall emergency plan. That's been done at the county level in every county as well. We do have a national pharmaceutical stockpile distribution plan so that we can receive the mass quantities of supplies, medications that would be available should we need those. We're working closely to make sure everything's coordinated within public health. We serve as the primary link with local health departments and their preparedness efforts. We've already talked about the work with the Governor's Security Council. In addition to that work, and one thing that I meant to bring you, and I'll get this to you, is a graphic that really does not photograph well, reproduce well, and that's why it's not included. But it really tries to show what are the different components of the system and how are they all coordinated. And one of the ways that we are coordinating that is there are weekly meetings of emergency management, state police, National Guard, public health, and DEQ, and Department of Administrative Services to make sure that we continue to coordinate well at the state level. We've coordinated the development of a 24/7 notification systems. We have our health alert network being enhanced, and that is a telecommunication strategy to make sure that we can get information, critical information, out to local health departments and other healthcare providers quickly. We're in the process right now of selecting a vendor for blast capacity so we can reach literally thousands of healthcare providers by phone, fax, and email with a push of the button. We've identified public information official in every local health department. We're developing communications plans, have one going right now for West Nile virus. We've been working very closely with the hospital association to get an assessment out so that we can find out what their needs are and what the needs of their regions are so that we can start funding those. And then another small piece of what we're doing is our public health preparedness also includes the chemical stockpile emergency preparedness program out at Umatilla, where we have one staff person who is providing support for the Office of Emergency Management on the medical health issues. So we're working with local health departments, with the first responders community, EMTs, paramedics, etc., and the hospitals to make sure that they are prepared in the event of a disaster with those chemical weapons. And then, while it's not included in here, I would also say that our office has done a lot of work on a couple of bills that I'm not sure you will see here, but hopefully you will be seeing, at least on the floor. One is House Bill 2410, which provides liability coverage for health care providers who volunteer during the time of a disaster. And then House Bill 2251, which would allow the governor to declare a state of crisis less than a emergency, where additional authority would be given to public health agencies so that we could deal with issues that, like I said, have not yet risen to the point of a crisis, of a true emergency, but still where we, if we had that authority, we could do better.
Kind of like an orange alert?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, orange alert?
Like a yellow or orange alert.
Well, it would I'm sure wait until we were at the red alert stage, but that's the idea, to give the governor a set of tools rather than just the ability to declare an emergency, which in some cases is a sledgehammer when you're trying to drive a small nail. The bioterrorism, the public health preparedness unit is fully funded by federal grants. That are the two grants from the Centers for Disease Control and Human Resources and Services Administration. The partnership that we have with local health department is critical for whatever we're doing in public health preparedness. And what we've decided as a public health system is to make sure that about half of all the monies that come into the state go directly to the locals for the work that they are doing. The Chemical Stockpile Emergency Preparedness Program does receive a small bit of general funds. That's under $100,000. We expect that the funding for these activities will continue at least the stable level. It also looks like for the hospital side of things that there's going to be substantial new dollars starting next year. Our share was $1.6 million this last funding cycle, and for next year it should be over $6 million. And this was expected that the first year was supposed to be for doing the assessment and planning, and then following years for additional purchasing of equipment, personnel that are needed.
So you're anticipating a substantial increase in federal dollars going to hospitals for to make sure they have their equipment and things are in place?
Chair Winters, that is correct. Also expect one other trend in the use of these dollars is we do think that we'll be expected to do more than just bioterrorism in the future. There's already been a push to start looking at some chemical issues, and I think that radiological and conventional issues will also be a requirement in the future as well. And so that was it on public health preparedness.
Senator Shields.
Yeah, in the next biennium, it is anticipated that section there at the end. Do you anticipate that any of this will change? I mean, I realize, you know, you got your $14.2 million back in the beginning of this cycle. Would any of this anticipated money change given the war in the Middle East now and the focusing of dollars on that military effort? Have you heard anything?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, we have not heard anything to make us believe that the funding would be reduced. And of course, you know, with the redirection of resources to the war effort, that's certainly something that we would have to be concerned about. But we've not heard anything yet. The other thing, though, to think about is that the war increases the risk of terrorism at home, as well as abroad, and particularly I think for biological agents and chemical agents. And so I would certainly hope that the federal government would see that this is a critical need for their continued funding.
Madam Chair, one comment, because I've heard these funds were in part to build local capacity in public health, but they come with a specific set of tasks, and the plan for this was developed with an advisory committee, and it's extraordinarily complicated and extensive. These are not dollars that replace what our effort has been with general funds from the state that do things like directly observe therapy for people with tuberculosis, which we have already have gaps in local health departments. So we've made some cuts this biennium in the support we provide to local health departments, but my own view is that it would be a mistake to think that the federal government is funding the things that we as a state have funded. And I hope that when we, Dr. Cohen is here, we can talk about some of those local health responsibilities as well, HIV, sexually transmitted diseases, and tuberculosis. HIV is considered not an acronym now, I think. So anyway. So I wanted to make that point because I hear...
Barry, you weren't like this in New York.
I know. You've trained me well, I think. Just a cautionary note.
Senator Shields.
No, and... You have to move on. Right, right.
Yes.
Health systems planning, I will try to be brief
Senator
on...
Excuse me, Senator Shields
on
has a question. Grant. You're still there, Grant.
I'm responding to what Barry was saying. The money that came from the feds, you know, is not to replace any of our general fund. It's new money. It's to build capacity. You said it came with a list of tasks to do. Were any of those a surprise to you? I mean, was this a redirection, a new direction for the state? I guess part of me almost wants to see, when new money arrives, I almost want to see the list that came with the money. You know what I'm saying?
You're suspect of the federal government.
Well, don't put words in my mouth, Madam Chair, but...
Well, I'm suspect, too.
Okay. Madam Chair, I have to say, because of what Dr. Higginson pointed out, that we've been ramping up here even before 9/11. I don't think this was a surprise, but it certainly is a much more coordinated and targeted effort. I think the point I was making is that it's not that whether they do or don't replace general funds. It's more what are the functions that the state was buying with its general fund investment? What are the functions that the federal government is buying with its allocation to Oregon? To the extent that there's an overlap, we might say, well, there's duplication. But my understanding is that we were way short to begin with, and you have a copy of the report we made to the emergency board to that effect. These funds don't backfill those shortages. They're for a different set of tasks. They have to do with preparedness. They have to do with information. They have to do with local capacity. And to some extent, it's an infrastructure development, but it won't go out and treat the person with tuberculosis, which was the example I chose. But I just think we've made some cuts there. We're taking some risks by reducing our investment. The federal government has not replaced that investment.
I have a couple of questions. One is, are we talking about categorical funding that you're referring to, number one? And number two, if we are, is it an increase of a current statute or is it a new one? And then what's the life?
And Madam Chair, it is new dollars for some specific activities that are spelled out in the guidance that we got from the Centers for Disease Control and Health Resources and Services Administration. On the other hand, though, one thing that we're trying to do is to make sure that wherever possible, we're using them in what we call dual capacity. So we've made enhancements at the public health laboratory. I mean, that's going to be good for their regular work that they do, as well as being able to be prepared for these new potential biological weapons. So we are trying to use them wisely, but they're not duplicative dollars. The life of the grant, we don't know for sure. We had the first set of funding through August of this year. We have been assured that there's going to be another year of stable level funding for the Centers for Disease Control piece and a substantial increase for the hospital piece. We have been told that for the foreseeable near future that this will be stable money. But like we say, we don't know how long this is going to be, and right now it is a year-by-year appropriations to current existing funding streams rather than a three-year or five-year grant.
So given that uncertainty, then capacity building is really where you're headed, because you don't want to go off into something new and not have the assurance of the dollars to continue.
Madam Chair, that is correct, but we're making sure that capacity that we're building helps us in our everyday work, as well as being prepared for the unthinkable disasters that might befall us. Okay. And I'm going to try to rush through other things. The next session is health systems planning. As you'll hear in a minute, for a number of years, we have had a strong partnership with local health departments. And that's in our community liaisons section. But a few years ago, we decided we really needed to be doing more in relationship building with the health care side as well. So the idea of creating a unit that provided a health system support and planning is how we got to health systems planning section. And what they do is work to help in providing access to primary health care, to reduce disparities in health services, to improve patient safety and increase the level of patient safety care. We do that in a variety of ways, such as designating underserved areas, underserved health shortage areas so that those communities have access to federal grants and other resources. We've been doing that by looking at disparity data to find out which people, minority groups, underprivileged individuals and groups of individuals have disparities in their health outcomes. And we've been working closely with hospital systems, health care provider organizations, consumers, and others to improve patient safety. Again, if you look at some of the accomplishments of health systems planning over the last biennium, that starts on page 4-6. We designated over 50 medically underserved areas. We have implemented a federal CONRAD program, which enables us to tap into a resource of foreign medical graduates who would otherwise have to go back to their country of origin, and we can use those physicians in medically underserved agencies. You will be receiving, I hope, a bill that deals with the funding of that program. House Bill 2151 has already passed out of the House Policy Committee with a due pass recommendation, and it would allow us to charge fees so that we can support the administration of that service. We've obtained a grant from the federal government to establish clinic for migrants and other underserved areas of the state. This is, again, trying to deal with the most vulnerable populations. We've improved the availability of data on disparities for racial and ethnic groups. We've assisted a number of communities in trying to obtain federal grants. We've been working with the Oregon Health Plan and others in the development of safety net clinics, and through our plans review and certificate of need program have also been working on patient safety issues. And then I think one of the major accomplishments of this unit over the past biennium has been the pulling together of a coalition that represents the Hospital Association, a variety of professional health care provider organizations, health purchaser groups, and the general public, and pulling together the idea of how can we promote a culture of patient safety, and how can we make sure that our facilities and our healthcare providers are promoting and providing as safe a care as possible. And through that work, there's been a creation of a bill, House Bill 2349, which has a hearing this week, which would create a pseudo create a public corporation whose mission would be to promote that patient safety through the review of medical errors.
Madam Chair,
health systems planning is funded through a combination of federal
Gordley.
And other.
Excuse me, Senator Gordley.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question about the health systems planning staffing. How many positions support the health systems planning function, and is it inclusive of the Office of Multicultural Health?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, right now there are 2 to 3 positions that are working on the planning function. That's been decreased with this most recent organization. One of the positions is working very closely, and I believe is partially funded by the Office of Multicultural Health, specifically working on those disparity issues.
And so then, Madam Chair, follow up. Every time I read the phrase then, reduce disparities in health services, in the section on health service systems planning, should I read that to mean the Office of Multicultural Health function as opposed to some function that's taking place with health systems planning? I'm just trying to tease out who's doing what and under what auspices.
Right, and Chairwoman Senator Gordley, we are working in collaboration in conjunction with the Office of Multicultural Health on that specific issue.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there any other questions on health systems planning? Okay. The next section is community liaison. And if I could have Linda Fleming from the Conference of Local Health Officials come up to the table and join us at this time. As I mentioned, and as Barry mentioned, really our primary partner, although we have a number of partners that we need to work with in public health, our primary partner is our local health departments, and we really do see ourselves as a public health system. And in fact, in some of the work that you were talking about earlier with the Restaurant Association on food services, one of our points to the Restaurant Association was that we really do need to use that public health system. We need to make sure that food services is linked with communicable disease and public health preparedness, and that the way that the system works here in Oregon, we think works best is to have a state agency that has the oversight, coordination, technical assistance, and consultation role, but then to have the local health departments that are providing the direct services. And Linda, as the executive director of the Conference of Local Health Officials, that's the statutory body that advises the state public health agency, is here just to provide a couple of comments as well. Every 3 years, we do an intensive review of every local health department. That's called our triennial review. And so over the past biennium, we reviewed 23 health departments. This is outlined in 4-9. We've managed a number of grants and contracts to local health departments. We also administer a Preventive Health and Human Services Block Grant. We serve as the primary liaison to the Conference of Local Health Officials. And help them throughout this past year, particularly in the implementation of the bioterrorism and public health preparedness activities. The community liaison section is, and here we're now in 410, is funded through a combination of federal and general dollars. This is where I said that there was a mistake, and actually it should be federal is 17% of the funding for that unit, and 83% of it is in general funds. The entire amount of that general funds is a pass-through to local health departments.
Grant, that's huge.
Pardon me? The 83%?
That's a huge reversal.
Yes, it is.
I like your other figures better.
Yeah, we don't want to change that.
And Chair Winters, the issue there was the way that the budget had been set up before, that 77% reflected the $6 million that was in our office for the public health preparedness side of things. Now that that is out and is a separate unit, it is now down to 17% federal, which is basically the Preventive Health Block Grant, and the 83% in general fund represents about the $4 million that, like I said, goes directly to local health departments, and these were funds that were cut by about close to $300,000 through the fifth special session. We do anticipate that the state and county general funds available will likely continue to decrease given the current budget crisis that we're facing. However, this does not negate the fact that we do have a number of public health laws that are mandated. The bioterrorism funds, as Barry was trying to point out, are providing some very specific tasks, and some of those augment the things that we're already doing, but clearly are not replacement dollars for the work that we're doing with local health departments. And again, as Barry mentioned, that the public health expectations may be unrealistic, and I think one good example of that is West Nile virus. In the first place, it in the overall scheme of things is not the major disease as some of the other diseases that we're facing, but it can be a very frightening disease. I am concerned that people are going to expect a massive public health response when West Nile virus hits the state of Oregon, and there simply are not those resources to be able to do that. And then the other thing that I did want to mention before turning this over to Linda for a minute is that there is a bill that has passed out of Senate and passed the Senate floor, Senate Bill 145, that in preamble talks about the framework that we would like to view public health services in the state of Oregon, and then that's followed by the request for a legislatively supported task force that would do an assessment and improvement plan to identify the gaps in current public health services and look for ways to make those improvements.
There are funds in your existing budget to support that task force, correct?
Madam Chair, we will support that task force internally if need be. We also will use that as a way to leverage foundation dollars to do a top-rated assessment and improvement plan process. And with that, I just turn it over to Linda if she would comment on our partnership.
Sure. My name is Linda Fleming. I'm the Executive Director of the Conference of Local Health Officials. We represent Oregon's 34 local health departments. As Grant said, he and Barry invited me here today just to make a few brief comments. I don't have a lot of prepared type of things. I've been sitting there taking notes on what both of them said. And I would say that we, when I say we, I mean local health departments, enjoy a good relationship with all of the offices in health services, the Department of Human Services. But today I was asked specifically to speak to the offices of the State Public Health Officer and the community liaison. Staff in this office and the community liaison understand local public health delivery systems and have probably fostered one of the best partnership approaches within the Department of Human Services. So we are strongly supportive of the efforts that they do there. They're a key point of contact for the local health department with the state agency. As Grant already told you, that's the office where our annual plan comes out of, the triennial review that evaluates the efficiency and effectiveness every 3 years with which each department is performing their functions. The standards by which they review us were actually developed in cooperation and collaboration with the Conference of Local Health Officials and is actually in statute that they do so. They also are primarily responsible for developing our service contracts with the scope of work that we will be providing over the next year. We do that cooperatively and collaboratively as well. Probably some of the most important things that office does for us, particularly if you're in the rural areas, around the areas of problem resolution, technical assistance, and consultation. The community liaison frequently travels to the rural parts of Oregon that doesn't enjoy some of the expertise and the capacity of Multnomah County or Marion County or Clackamas County. So that's just it's invaluable to counties like Wheeler and Grant and Morrow and Harney and Malheur County. Of course, we've been working closely with that office and with Mel Cohn's office when he comes up to talk about preparedness planning and bioterrorism. In another thing just this year, though, that has become very important to us is a new approach to working with local health departments and other agencies under the Department of Human Services umbrella to develop new waivers and processes for us to maximize the federal Medicaid match. We've been working diligently on that, and I think a new approach to that is just going to start in April of this year. So we're highly hopeful, and that's something that had not been available to us.
Could you elaborate a little further on the new waiver and the maximization of Medicaid match?
Chair Winters, in the past, local health departments have been able to access funds, Medicaid match, through targeted case management and services to reproductive health services for women. We have not been able as well to capture administrative match for other things that we do as part of our public health system. So the Conference of Local Health Officials worked with health services to develop a waiver process and apply to the federal government so that public health now could start getting some administrative match similar to what education service districts do for schools, that sort of things. And so I believe we now have 17 counties on board to start piloting that with the hope that it will eventually go to all counties. So that's the effort that's underway right now. There's only one thing I would like to comment on, and that was Chair Winter's question in terms of who's the first line of response. And, of course, from the state's perspective, of course, state police, Office of Emergency Management, and health services. At the local level, we see the first line of response as being the local level counterparts to those that they just mentioned. The threat will come to local law enforcement. Emergency response will go to local emergency management, and the health and medical will come to the local health department. If I understand the plan that we're putting together now with health services, then they would assist at the health services, and others would assist at local request. And at the same time, we're looking to health services and others to coordinate cross-jurisdictional response as well as assist in assuring mutual aid agreements statewide. So I just did want to clarify that. It depends on who you're asking as to where the first line of response is.
Question. Linda, you mentioned that there were 34, I believe, members to the a council, and maybe I'm making some false assumptions, but I'm assuming that those are counties, and if it is, where are the other two counties?
Madam Chair, there are 34 local health departments in Oregon. Wasco-Sherman County has formed one health department. Gillum County has waived its local public health authority, and the state of Oregon is actually the local public health authority for Gillum County.
So Gillum does not have?
Madam Chair, Gillum County does not have a local health department.
Thanks.
Right. And Madam Chair, I've agreed to finish up in 2 minutes so Multicultural Health can have the rest of the day. And just to say that the final section is special projects, that the big special project there is medical marijuana, which is a program that we have statutory responsibility to run a registration system. That program has increased dramatically over the past biennium. We now have about 4,700 patients who are registered in that system. We think that following some audits that were done by the department about a year ago, that we've made substantial improvements to the way that the program functions, and right now we think that it is running smoothly, and our role is really to be the balance between making sure that we're giving good client service to those people who qualify for the program, but on the other hand trying to work to make sure that there are no abuses. And with that,
you're talking about the medical marijuana program.
Medical marijuana program, correct.
I know that you've done some aggressive work to make sure that there isn't abuses within that system. And I think the last time you came before us, there was some real investigations going on among some doctors. And so can you tell us how well that has proceeded?
Chair Winters, I think that it has provided better guidance for what constitutes the qualifications for an attending physician, which I think was an important thing that needed to be done. We also, over the past couple of years, have identified a number of programmatic problems and consequently have been working through another bill, 3516. Actually, maybe 3156, but it's one sponsored by Oregon Narcotics Enforcement Agency to work at trying to resolve some of those programmatic issues, and we're hopeful that will pass. That's in Representative Cruz's committee at the current time, and it is his bill.
And you're not seeing just a handful of doctors now who are writing?
Chair Winters, we are not. There's over 600, actually there may be close to 1,000 physicians who have now written prescriptions. There are some physicians that have more patients than others, one in particular, but there are a large number of physicians who are now participating.
Good afternoon.
Welcome, Vicki.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Vicki Nakashima, and I'm the Director of the Office of Multicultural Health for the department. I'm here today to give you an overview of the Office of Multicultural Health's budget and hopefully answer any questions you may have. We are a small, diverse office of 5.5 full-time employees, who we were founded or started in 1994 in Department of Human Services. During this biennium, our role has been expanded to include not only public health, but also mental health and addictions and the Oregon Medical Assistance Program. And the office now reports to the Assistant Administrator, Barry Cast, for health services. So our reach is much broader than it was when we were here at the last budget period. The reductions are listed in your document under page 4-4-101, and those cuts have impaired our ability to perform the many duties we have, but we're very pleased with the work we've been able to accomplish. The reason that we exist is to eliminate the disproportionate burden of disease, disability, and death among specific racial and ethnic groups in Oregon. And there are federal and state mandates. The federal mandates have started as early as 1998 with Healthy People 2010 and the National Institute of Health passing legislation to create offices of minority health at the federal level, and also the Bureau of Primary Health Care, which initiated a zero disparities initiative nationwide. In 1999, the governor created, through executive order, the Task Force on Racial and Ethnic Health and identified six priority areas that were of concern here in Oregon. And those areas were access to health and mental health care, alcohol and drug services, diabetes, lead, poisoning, childhood lead poisoning, HIV/AIDS, and asthma. Those areas were the focus of a 21-member task force who addressed those issues and presented a report in November of 2000 prior to the legislative session, and in that report outlined four major areas of strategy that in each of the areas there were many disproportionate burdens, but in terms of strategies we were looking at increasing the cultural competency of the existing system, addressing the need for additional data on racial and ethnic populations and how they were disproportionately impacted by those disparities, the workforce that delivers the services in Oregon, and access to health and mental health care in Oregon. Those were the four major cross-cutting strategies. I will cover some of the disparities that exist to point out some of the problems that the communities in Oregon are most concerned about that are examples that I think illustrate why we need to address the disparities in Oregon. These are examples. In the year 2000, 33% of the Native American women in Oregon went without prenatal care during the first trimester. Asian women are five times more likely to get cervical cancer. One out of four African American women over the age of 55 has diabetes. African Americans are 2.6 times more likely, and Native Americans three times more likely to have diabetes. And not only does diabetes affect, but there are many additional complications that result. African Americans make up over 30% of all patients on dialysis in this country and are 18 times more likely than Caucasians to develop kidney failure from hypertension. Hispanics have the highest rate of being uninsured in Oregon. 24.5% of all Hispanics in Oregon are uninsured, compared to 11.8% of whites. And in the area of workforce, Hispanics represent less than 2% of all nurses in Oregon. So those are some of the areas that caused the task force to look at those cross-cutting issues. I would like to recognize that in the audience today are two members of the task force and two guests. Corliss McKeever is the director, executive director, and CEO of the African American Health Coalition in Portland, and Jackie Mercer is the executive director of the Native American Rehabilitation Association. In addition, Bill Beamer and Colleen Faddis are here as guests in the audience from the African American Health Coalition.
Could you have? I don't know who those people are. Could you just have raise your hand?
Let's see. They're part of my relatives out there.
All right.
Jackie Mercer is Native American, and Jackie is also involved with the alcohol and drug program. Corliss is, and I say that fondly because we play with, when I get a chance to go to Portland to visit with my relatives. And Lane and Beamer.
Thank you very much.
If time allows, they wanted to make just a few remarks, if that's all right, Madam Chair and members.
That's fine, Vicki.
I wanted to give you some examples of projects that we've been involved in and will continue to be involved in during the next biennium, which I think are critical to the work of eliminating health disparities in Oregon. Around data, we have been able to, through the recommendations of the task force, many of the recommendations were for far-reaching, and we did not have the resources to address. The money of the $500,000 that was added to our budget during the 01-03 biennium, toward the end of the biennium, ended up being $80,000, but we're grateful for the $80,000. That money has been was really the resource to help us perform some of this work. We have been successful in bringing in additional money. Our general fund budget, the amount of general fund money we have in our office is $294,734. We have a total of $212,351 in other funds and $1,032,953 in federal funds. Some of that is, a good piece of that is through resources, projects that we've gone after. We have a major state and territorial demonstration grant to involve communities of color in HIV and AIDS education and outreach. We have a project to train bilingual and bicultural nurses in Oregon and have generated other projects that I will mention briefly that have brought in resources from the community and from the corporate sector. Around data, we've been working with other DHS agencies as well as the task force members to identify strategies for improving the access we have to qualitative and quantitative data. In states with very small populations of color, although our populations are growing rapidly, Oregon is one of the 10 fastest growing in terms of Hispanic population in the country, we still have a need for additional information to help support the need for funding from federal sources and other competitive sources outside of Oregon. And the data is critical to that effort. In the area of cultural
Senator Gordley. Madam Chair, yes. Thank you. Is a part of what you're saying there is that we could be more competitive for federal grants if we had data to help make our case, and that we may in fact be missing opportunities to gain federal dollars and other grants? Is that a part of the concern?
Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, that is a concern. There are a number of states in the country that have small minority populations and communities of color, and in order to compete for funds, often you need to be able to demonstrate there is a disparity and that the disparity is serious enough to warrant an initiative that requires outside funding. And we have found that many of our techniques to collect information, for example, we have a behavioral risk factor survey that's conducted via telephone. We have found that that's very difficult to collect information broadly based around communities of color because the random sampling in order to achieve that survey does not necessarily bring forward enough information on communities of color in Oregon. So the cost of performing additional oversampling is expensive but also time-consuming. And we also find that often, for example, the community that has the least access to telephones is the Native American community. So it makes it very difficult if we don't have other ways of collecting information that will help us demonstrate the needs that we have.
And so, follow-up, Madam Chair, what progress are we making with regard to moving away from inappropriate, inadequate data collection to data that is more appropriate and that can help Oregon make the case for more grant dollars, more federal funds to help deal with some of these issues around disparity?
Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, the data group has been instrumental in initiating projects that identify how do we mine the data that we already have to better demonstrate. And in some cases, we are able to array the information differently in order to support support the needs in the community. In other cases, we're initiating major projects to look at different sources of information. Right now, in cooperation with the staff that Grant Higginson described in the health policy area, we've been able to begin a project to look at diabetes information in the Latino community that will take a different qualitative approach to looking at research. We're also looking at a partnership with Providence Health System that would allow us to look at, they have, in their efforts to look at disparities, have found that they do not have good information on their clients, their patients who are in the hospital system or in their clinics or managed care programs, and have taken on an initiative to be able to begin doing that. And they're doing that in cooperation with our office and with the Oregon Medical Assistance Program. And through the leadership of the data group and through the work of Grant Higginson's staff, we will be able to initiate an effort to see if we can get major hospitals, not just Providence, but other major hospitals interested in doing a more collaborative approach to collecting data that will help us demonstrate actual incidence and prevalence of disease and treatment and barriers to access to health care through our private sector partners.
Vicki, where are we in the comparison of funding, both federal funding and other funding with other states that are comparable to our size and comparable to our population?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the Office of Multicultural Health in Oregon is one of 34 recognized offices of minority health around the country. We're the only one in Region 10, which covers Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Alaska. There are only a few offices on actually the West Coast. Most of them are East Coast. I cannot tell you, there's some surveys going on presently to look at the resources of offices of minority health. We do know that there are some who've actually been defunded. I'm not aware of comparison in terms of funding. I know many of them work strictly in the area of public health. They do not have the reach across mental health and addictions and the Office of Medical Assistance programs that we have. I have been to two meetings in my 3 years with other state directors and stay in touch, and I feel that our office is quite aggressive in our activities. We're one of only a couple that have had a statewide initiative around a task force around racial and ethnic health, and we've been a leader and consulted many times about the work of that task force and the strategies for continuing their work.
So even though you do not have the kind of the availability of data that you want, we really have, when you tell me that we're the only one in the Northwest and specific Northwest and that we rank pretty high naturally from what I can gather from the conversation. And my suspicion is when knowing, I knew Vicki in the past too, and knowing the aggressiveness, particularly of branchmanship that exists in this state, that we don't leave too much left unturned when it comes to try to find resources.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think we have been quite creative in our strategies. I can tell you that there are a number of resources that we've used, including we've had contributions from the private sector for projects that we've undertaken. We even had, I don't want to pique anyone's interest, but we've actually had a contribution from the wine growers in Washington County who are concerned about the health of the workers, the migrant seasonal farm workers on their wineries, and who've created a foundation called the Salud Fund, close to $1 million foundation that's connected with Tualatin Health Foundation or Tualatin Health System, and they have actually contributed to our efforts to learn more about healthcare in Mexico and have helped us. So we have a variety. I mean, we try very hard to find additional resources. We currently have requests in cooperation with a private sector partner or nonprofit partner to conduct the second phase of a nursing project to train bilingual and bicultural nurses through a partnership with six other hospitals and medical clinics in Oregon. And that project, we have requests into the Office of Minority Health at Department of Health and Human Services and the Meyer Memorial Trust.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to ask a really blunt question, and maybe it's going to sound insensitive, but I truly don't mean it to be, because I want an answer, and I'm hoping you'll give me a blunt answer. I don't understand why there's a discrepancy among racial and ethnic groups in terms of their access to health services. To me, it would seem more of a financial issue or a regional issue than a ethnic issue.
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, access to health care takes on many dimensions, economics, the work environment and whether coverage is available. But we also have many people who are uninsured and still have access to health insurance, to health care. And in this situation, people of color have been impacted not only in the workplace but economically, the ability to acquire affordable health insurance. We have many people who are working and working poor who cannot afford insurance. So there is an element of economics that runs across all racial and ethnic groups. We also know that cultural barriers. You can have health insurance and still not have culturally appropriate service delivered. We have communities in Oregon that, because of language barriers, cannot access service.
And I just truly want to understand this. Can you give me an example, say, for diabetes, how one
maybe I can help out a little bit.
Ethnic group.
You have three up here who could probably talk to you at some great length about the four and the doc on this particular subject. Diabetes, for example, when you look at the population, it's only until recently where you begin to educate people that there is a preponderance more in certain groupings than there are in other groups. And if they don't have the information, you have a situation where you have a higher incidence of death, you have a higher incidence of individuals going without being treated. You also have what I like to call benign neglect. That benign neglect tends to happen more frequently, I don't care if you do have access to health, in those particular communities. It would be very nice if everyone in all of our various fields, whether we're talking about health fields and others, came to the table without having certain biases and blinders on. But that's not the case. The fact is that the Hispanic community, for example, you're talking language barriers. You're also talking about issues that have to do with the a number of individuals who are in that field that can even interpret or understand the various cultural differences. So that's a piece. We know that you don't have, if you're looking at Corliss, who lives in the metropolitan Portland in the Albina area, there's some distinctive barriers and problems that occur in those communities. So there are some barriers and some differences that exist. In the issue when we talked about pharmaceuticals, for example, when you get into that study, you find that some people metabolize medicine different than others because of their ethnic backgrounds. And yet if you go to see the doctor, they don't take those kinds of things into consideration. So there's some educating, there's some things that are unique, and that was the reason for creating this multicultural peace in health. It's too important, the health issue, I think that, you know, I think Oregon was wise in talking about, we know that there's some barriers. We would like to educate our community, and we would like to do some things to make sure that we're all inclusive.
So Chair Winters, so I can go to sleep tonight knowing that ethnic groups are not being turned away for access to care, the quality. Let me be very blunt with what I'm concerned about. Okay. I want to make sure that every citizen in the state of Oregon has an equal and open access to care. And I want to know why that's not occurring. And maybe that's a discussion for another day for you and I to go have lunch. But I want to be able to sleep at night when I vote on this budget, knowing that I'm voting to ensure every Oregon Oregonian has equal opportunity to health care.
I think I kind of framed my response that it's unfortunate that all of us don't think the way, same way, see the same things, and understand that there are barriers that are there that have been placed over there of a long history of time. And
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Gordley.
I really appreciate Representative Smith's question and the intent to understand behind the question. And I want to say to us, unfortunately, with our running out of time, we may miss the opportunity to hear this afternoon from two experts who are sitting patiently in the audience who participate with the governor's racial and ethnic health task force and who have an even deeper perspective than what you've heard about why these barriers exist and what it is we need to do and can do to remove these barriers. Corliss McKeever, Jackie Mercer.
And I think rather than having, because I don't want them to come back, but the time is there, I think I'll bring the two of them up now, if it's all right with you, Vicki, and have them to share and to respond, because they're on the front line and they're dealing with this issue and this question.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Corliss McKeever. I'm President and Chief Executive Officer of the African American Health Coalition. I'm also a member of the Governor's Racial and Ethnic Health Task Force and of the Council of Substance Abuse Prevention Programs. Thank you very much for your question. Just briefly, I have to make one plug about access. Two kinds of access exist, internal and external. External access is the question I think you were asking, can people get in? That's very important. The fact that people of color die disproportionately from preventable diseases, it's where the disparity exists. And having a medical card, as I think Senator Winters mentioned, is crucial, but how you're treated when you get there will determine whether you reappear for preventative services. Definitely you'll go if you're half dead or in excruciating pain, but will you come and get a mammogram, which is disproportionately impacted for our community, and other screenings that are crucial to prevention, and that's a major issue. And so the whole issue around cultural competency and all the other things that you've heard briefly. But even above that, a couple of years ago, Dr. David Satcher, only the second person in history to hold the position of Secretary of Health and the Surgeon General of the United States, visited Oregon, and he said at the conference sponsored by the Office of Multicultural Health that the health disparity is a civil rights issue. And it truly is. Anytime you continually have a population or populations with poorer health outcomes than mainstream America, that is a civil rights issue, and that's why it's so crucial. The health disparity exists in times when resources are plentiful, and it's even more crucial in times like this, looking at the current climate that we have in Oregon and in every state of the nation. Some of the things that I heard, too, about the Office of Multicultural Health were, are we getting as much funding nationally as we can? And I just want to speak briefly, because I know we're out of time, about two funding streams that have opened up to my organization, the African American Health Coalition, as a result of partnership with the Office of Multicultural Health. We have received a commitment of over $7 million over the next 5 years, a small community-based organization of 12 staff, and that's directly related to our relationship with Office of Multicultural Health, the State Office of HIV, and the Office of Chronic Illness and Disease Prevention. To be able to deliver a grant of that capacity is major. Thank you. I needed that so bad. To be able to deliver a grant to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention and SAMHSA, Substance Abuse Mental Health and Services Administration, was directly related to our ability to get data from DHS and to have it analyzed, to deliver focus groups and have them analyzed so that we can compete. It was major competition, over 500 applications, and only 15 in round two, and actually 7 in the final round, and we were the second highest application based on our relationship with that department. Most small CBOs don't have the ability or capacity to deliver a grant of that magnitude, and we are missing multiple opportunities without our ability to collect data. data collection is crucial. Data is dollars. And if you have a population like African Americans, less than 2% of the total population, too many times the data is not available. So the partnership with the Office of Multicultural Health and DHS in general, it has been crucial for us to be able to obtain that level of funding. And I'll just cut it there. I can say a lot more, trust me, and because I want to hear from my colleague Jackie Mercer.
Welcome, Jackie.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'll just say a couple quick things. One is that for Native American people, they're 740% more likely to die from alcohol-related issues. I mean, it's probably one of the biggest numbers that I know of that illustrate the disparity. And that disparity in terms of access to care is really a very important illustration, I think, to be able to show that even when people have insurance, even when people have money, even when people, and we know this in our own clinic, that people have insurance, my own staff, and they won't go to other mainstream places, primarily in regards to trust and respect. And you can go into the history of Indian health services in this country and take a look at sort of the racial and ethnic issues that have happened in this country with every group and sort of understand that people feel that they won't be treated well, that they often are not treated well, and that there are huge communication problems that happen. The other number that I'll give you is another number that came out of the Surgeon General's report, which is that for Native American youth, 15 to 25 boys, they're 50 times more likely to kill themselves than any other group. And so, you know, when I say those numbers, one of the things that I always think of, and I may have said to some of you all before, is that those are epidemic numbers, and yet in this country there's not an epic response. And I think that if there's anything that illustrates more the need for our work, you know, we can, as Corliss said, we can give you lots of data and information, and we'd be really, really happy to be able to have that opportunity to do that, because it is an issue that unless every Oregonian has access to health care and access to services and access to financial and other means, then all Oregonians suffer. And I think that's pretty much what I'll say. I could say a lot, but I'll be quiet. But thank you.
I think I have a line up here. Senator Gordley, Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. From your perspectives, then, how should we look at the budget reduction that was referenced earlier? What is the impact on the work that you all are involved in every day in the community, and from where you sit on the Racial and Ethnic Health Task Force?
Sure. Oh, sorry, I thought you said you were. It's a little miscommunication here between the quarterback and whoever I am. I think that one of the things that really concerns me about the process that we're in now is that several things. One of them is that when you look at already who's on Oregon Health Plan, who's on CHIPS, who's on waiting list for those programs, I think you'll find that our communities, while they are maybe represented by numbers, are not as represented as it would be if you really looked at the disparity issue. So already we're in a disadvantaged place. The second thing is that as those things go away, we're often not at the table when people start talking about how they're going to come back. And unless you really gear services for what each community needs, those services will not reach the communities. And those are tremendous issues. I can tell you that for our health clinic and our alcohol and drug program, that we'll see probably, as it stands right now, less than 150 people, whereas last year we saw 500 people in our outpatient and chemical dependency program. And you know, it is just sort of continues to be a huge issue for us.
I'm sure you know that substance abuse impacts every other system.
For the record, it's Corliss.
I'm sure you know that substance abuse impacts every other system available. And just a quick scenario of what's already taken place: the cuts for Project for Community Recovery, which is one of the main outpatient treatment centers in North Northeast Portland, predominantly African American, has had a reduced staff to about 1.5. And they currently have 4 staff members. The only reason they have 4 staff members in place is because of our partnership and the federal grant in which we subcontracted to them through the SAMHSA grant. If it weren't for, and that grant is to try to coordinate services and train HIV counselors, substance abuse counselors to deliver HIV education. If it were not for that grant, that program would be almost non-existent. And that is just major in the North Northeast community to not have PCR as a service agency for people who want to come into outpatient treatment.
I've got Corliss. She's got a phone coming to
Project Community Recovery.
Rosie wants money, not.
Ooh.
Rosie.
Okay. Senator Shields.
I wanted to ask Jackie to repeat that statistic that she gave us a minute ago because I wanted to comment on it. 740%
more likely to die from alcohol related causes.
Yes. Native Americans, 740% more likely to die. I just wanted to comment in my own journey that if you'd given me that statistic 25 years ago, I would have said, well, if Indians didn't drink so much, they wouldn't be dying. And the reality is that Caucasians introduced Native Americans to alcohol 400 to 500 years ago. There's no way Native Americans have the kind of resistance to alcohol that we've developed over the last 50,000 years of using wine and alcoholic beverages in Europe and so on. And so often I've run into that kind of thing. I pastored a church in Chiloquin where there was a whole lot of racism about quote-unquote drunken Indians. And it's the kind of reality that I run into still in portions of Oregon, you know, when we're talking about health disparities and alcoholism rates and so on. I just wanted to put that in the hopper.
Well, you know, not only alcoholism, but they introduce some other diseases that killed off tribes. But here again, I think my comment that I made earlier is that we don't all metabolize things the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are some distinctions, and it's those distinctions that you're trying to get the communities to understand. Representative Bates.
Just one more
quick. I think Representative Smith and then Representative Bates.
Oh. Sorry about that. Thank you, Chair Winters. This has been a really good day. Very eye-opening. You know, an observation I have is that in the lending community, banks have what's called the Community Reinvestment Act. And it almost seems like in healthcare we ought to have a Patient Reinvestment Act to ensure that, you know, if our healthcare providers are going to live and work in a community and take money from that community, they're providing the level of service that community needs.
I just want to add,
very interesting.
If the problems are in the community, so are the solutions. And we're experiencing a lot of that with the racial and ethnic approaches to community health grant. See, I didn't say reach. And part of what makes that possible, to tie this all together, are the community's ability to solve their own problems. And that really comes from a very strong partnership of being able to have someone like the Office of Minority Multicultural Health be the liaison, because many small community-based organizations that are doing excellent work really do not know how to compete on the federal level. They don't have that capacity, and we have the ability to get those resources through partnerships and be able to deliver data. But when it really comes down to implementing those programs, they really need to be community-based, and there is an opportunity for folks like DHS who have experience and working with the federal systems to bring the funding to the community, and then the money really needs to go to the community to solve their own problems. It's just my personal opinion.
Representative Bates.
Just to add 2 quick points to the discussion here, I guess. I think of the 2 P's when I think of this, professionals and poverty. We do not recruit enough minorities, as a general rule, into the professions. We do not go out and do outreach and recruit them in. And without that happening, there's that natural barrier is going to be there for years in the future. And when we've looked at these things, as we've seen our professional schools come through and the percentage of ethnic minorities in there, it's just not happening yet. And that's something we have to change. The other thing is you work in areas not of ethnic minorities, but you also work in areas of poverty. Mm-hmm. And that's a big factor in getting good health care into those areas also. And you're stepping up to fill the gap. But that's other P, I think, of is poverty. If those people are interested in how this all happened, I recommend a book called Guns, Germs, and Steel. Mm-hmm. If you haven't read that, it's illuminating what the European population and culture did to the Native American population and to the Native population of Africa.
I'd just like to add to that briefly. Recruitment is one issue, but retention is even greater. We've recruited some major bright minds from all over the country, but because you're one, either the only one or one of two, the system doesn't necessarily embrace you and support you when you do reach in. And we really have to look at training our own folks, the clerks in the medical field and the folks in the community college, to really get people up to the level where they can, who want to be in Oregon also. That's been the problem, because it's a culture shock to be here if you're from an all-black city or a major city. So we really have to look at some innovative approaches and ways that we can retain our own. And there's another book I'd like to recommend. It's called An American Health Dilemma. Not African American, but An American Health Dilemma, which really traces the medical provider's responsibility to reduce the disparity.
Vicki, do you have any pearls of wisdom to offer at the end?
Madam Chair, and members of the committee, we appreciate the opportunity to be here. I have a couple of projects that if the time allows tomorrow to come back and just give you an update on some of the projects that I think illustrate some of the strategies of how we eliminate those disparities. But I want to thank
you. With that, we will, you can bring us back tomorrow, and hopefully we will keep our pace and won't keep you behind time. But, you know, this was a worthwhile discussion. And thank you for raising the question, Representative Smith, because there was some good dialogue. Mm-hmm. And I look forward to seeing you tomorrow. And, Carlos, mm-hmm. You owe Rosie.
I'm going to pay Rosie before
that,
I go.
We are adjourned.